Just a few minutes, we'll be hearing from human factors engineer David Metropolis Rundus. You may never heard of ergonomics, but you will be glad you have after this week's first segment, because we'll talk about whether that pain in the neck is physical and not just psychological, and if so, what you might just be able to do about it. So be ready with your questions just a few minutes from now. Then in the second segment, well, that portion of the program is, shall we say, brought to you by the letter E. Of course, we're talking about email, electronic mail, and what it can do for you. We'll be talking with Ted Mead of the Picture City Personal Computer Programming Club. Then Sam Whitmore of PC Week talks about all the latest developments and why computer companies seem to want to say they're not in the computer business. But first, the latest computer news. You've heard plenty this week about the restructuring of IBM, which will send 10,000 North American employees packing through a combination of attrition and early retirements. But what will it mean to the personal computer user community? Well, we put that question to a man who follows the fortunes of the computer giant very closely, namely Wall Street Journal correspondent Paul Carroll. He told Soundbites IBM is trying to trim down to be more competitive in both pricing and product lines. And we can expect to see some aggressive new product development in the months ahead.
We have a very impressive guy who's running that business now. He's a real let me at him type who will just fight any fight anybody lets him fight. And while I think his hands will be tied for a while because of the traditional IBM development process.
Meanwhile, Big Blue has already regained some of the market share in the core desktop computer market that it lost due to production and quality problems in the past year. While we had Paul Carroll on the line, we asked him to look at more general trends in the computer industry, and he told us that laptop and notebook-sized machines are going to be the hottest growth area again next year.
I am especially a big fan of these notebook machines. It's been unbelievable to me to see the reaction that those machines have gotten. I was at a dinner a week ago. I wound up spending a little time afterward with the chairman of Compaq, who was just dazzling people with the little machine that he had brought along.
Carroll predicts that IBM will turn its attention to that market within the next 12 to 18 months. Intel says it has corrected the flaws in its new SuperPower 80486 series microchip and has begun shipping it again in volume. This means volume production and shipments of more powerful PCs based on the 486 chip is probably just weeks away. Compaq has already announced its Desk Pro 486 models using the more powerful circuit. IBM will resume making and shipping upgrade circuit boards for its PS2 line and may soon announce a PS2 specifically designed for the chip. Some computer users who try to mate Lotus 1-2-3 with the Microsoft Windows program are finding it's not such a hot marriage. Lotus Development's W. Frank King says there is, in his words, a collision in memory management between the 1-2-3 spreadsheet package and the Windows 386, which is supposed to make most IBM-compatible machines easier to use. That means Lotus users could find trouble if they try to make use of some of the features of the Windows program when they're doing spreadsheet work. Microsoft says Lotus was aware of the trouble several years ago, but would not make needed modifications to adapt 1-2-3 to Windows. Lotus, meanwhile, says it's Microsoft's attempt to force Windows users to buy its related application software, which is to blame. A major hard disk drive manufacturer is ending all its American manufacturing operations. The financially troubled Miniscribe company says it is closing its Longmont, Colorado plant and idling 150 production workers permanently. All production will be located in Singapore and Hong Kong. The company is also dropping about two-thirds of its product lines, concentrating on its new 1-inch high drives on which it is basing hopes for survival. Online services for PC users are spreading out into the banking field. Prodigy, the online joint venture of Sears and IBM, says it has signed agreements with 15 regional banking institutions ranging from New England to the West, and is now seeking additional customers in the banking community at about $500,000 per bank. If your bank eventually becomes part of the network, most routine transactions, including bill paying and account transfers, can be handled through your PC. Small to medium-sized loan applications could also be processed electronically. Meanwhile, Prodigy System is farming out its data storage facilities in the Northeast to Nynex Corporation, the parent of the statewide New York telephone company. Soon, your laptop computer may be without a screen, but that will not mean you can't see what you're doing. Cyberspace Corporation of Norcross, Georgia, has come up with a lightweight eyepiece worn on a headband which will make information normally shown on a computer screen appear floating in midair in front of you. What is more, only you and no one else will be able to see the display, which means your work can be even more confidential than current screen displays permit. The key is an eyepiece element developed by Reflection Technologies of Massachusetts using light-emitting elements, lenses, and oscillating mirrors. One of the first applications could come from Selectronics Corporation of Pittsburgh. They're interested for the line of pocket dictionaries and encyclopedias. That's this week's Computer News. You're listening to Soundbites on WXXI 1370, and of course our line's now open at 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Ergonomics. That word might not have much of a meaning to you, but believe me, the concept does, because what it's really all about is how comfortable, easy, and safe things are to use, how convenient things are, how comfortable it is, for example, to sit in front of your monitor and your keyboard, perhaps for long periods of time, all day, maybe every day. David Metropoulos-Rundus is an engineer of ergonomics and human factors. He's going to tell you how to maximize the ergonomics, the comfort, if you will, of computer use. David, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Now, last week, of course, we talked to a certain degree about the radiation and the electromagnetic fields and the rest. I'm wondering if, similarly, there might be any potential dangers, maybe not necessarily to life or to long-term health, but certainly to comfort, from the actual sheer physical layout of our computer workstations.
Yes, there are, and I just might add that I wouldn't consider them dangers, but more in the neighborhood of discomforts. Things like neck muscle pain, perhaps even back muscle pain, or eye strain, and sometimes things like arthritis might be aggravated by prolonged punching away at a keyboard.
So what bottom line is maybe we're not endangering ourselves necessarily from those long hours slaving in front of a hot keyboard, but we sure can be a lot more comfortable than we are then.
Right.
Now, let's first of all look at the most obvious question that I'm sure a lot of people are going to ask, because the first thing you see when you sit down at a computer is the screen, the monitor screen. And I would bet you anything that probably under certain circumstances you can get all kinds of eye strain and eye problems from that. What are some of the complaints that people have?
I think the most common complaints are overhead lighting causing glare on the screen, inability to focus, or eye fatigue, which may come from sitting either too close to the monitor or too far away, causing the person to squint or strain their eyes while they're trying to read the monitor screen for prolonged periods of time.
And all of these things can, I suppose, happen just even before you realize it or before you know it, then.
Right.
Well, if there's eye fatigue, first of all, let's look at the ambient light situation, because that's something that could easily be controlled. I suppose it can anyway. What seems to be the big problem there? Is it like an office that's too dim or an office that's too bright, or can both be harmful?
Both can be a problem. The most common complaint is when the office is too bright, you've got overhead lighting reflecting off the monitor screen. There's a couple of quick fixes you can do. One is tilt your monitor down somewhat if you can. There's also glare reduction screens that can be placed over the monitor, and those can be obtained through most computer catalogs or computer places. They'll have one to fit your screen.
Are they pretty cheap most of the time?
Yeah, I can't tell you the exact price range, but they're very reasonable.
So go see your boss and tell him, hey, I've got to have one of these.
Go see your boss, you got it.
And hope that he responds, I guess. But most cases he should if he's responsible, right?
Also, in a brightly lit environment, it's sometimes you may not realize that the brightness or contrast on your monitor is turned down or is not as much as it should be.
So you can control that to a certain degree.
Absolutely.
Now, something else I wonder about this, too, and that is the question of color. Now, I've seen all kinds of monitor colors. I've seen monochromes in various types. I've seen some that are in color, in fact, and I've seen all kinds of displays that are out there. I'm wondering, first of all, if there's an ideal color, first of all, for a monochrome monitor. Do you want it maybe light green against deep green, or do you want it light blue against black or deep blue, or do you want it just black and white with with nothing, no coloration or no tinting on it. I'm wondering if there's one color scheme that's easier on the eyes than any other.
Well, first of all, the most important thing with computer screens is they go opposite the printed page, in that you always want the characters light and the background dark. In terms of what's the best color combination, the answer is the one which you can read the best. You want to pick two colors which allow you to read the characters very quickly and easily. You also want to have the maximum contrast.
Now, of course, I've seen dark, rather light green, very light green characters on the screen seem to be among the most popular, if not the most popular. Is that getting to be kind of a de facto standard for some reason?
I don't know if it's becoming a de facto standard. Like I said, I think the most important thing is that the difference between your background and your characters is great, and on most screens that I see with green characters, the background is almost always dark, as in black, and I think that that's, I don't know if that's optimum, but it's certainly quite acceptable.
So, no problem with that. It's certainly okay if you happen to be among the norm.
Yes, and I know people who pick different colors, or every once in a while they just get bored with the colors on their screen and go in and change them. And the only advice I have to that is go ahead and do it, pick colors that you like, but just make sure that you're not compromising the contrast or ability to read what's up there.
Our number is 263-WXXI, 263-9994, and we invite your questions on this segment of Sound Bites, because what we're talking about right now is really important to everybody who spends any length of time working at a computer or at a workstation at all, and that is your comfort, your visual comfort, your physical comfort, and how best to maximize it. David Metropoulos Rundus is a human factors engineer who works on that kind of problem really all of his professional time, and he can help you perhaps in designing the most optimum workstation environment and workstation arrangement for you. 263-WXXI, 263-9994 is our number. We're going to be getting to the phones in just a second. I'm curious about something that I heard recently that I saw on a television broadcast and was also repeated here on this radio station in an NPR report, and that was that certain people under certain circumstances, long hours of almost constant work at a keyboard workstation, I think in this case they were information operators, but I suppose people processing huge amounts of data like for a bank or something like that can get into this too, were constantly at the keyboard and then developing something not unlike that carpal tunnel syndrome that meat cutters and machine tool operators get. Is that something that's relatively new, or is that something that's prevalent right now? Are we just beginning to find out about this?
I think, Bob, that we're beginning to find out about it. I would say that with today's keyboards, which require very little action to activate, it's never going to be a big issue. I think rather it's going to be the exception than the rule that anybody's going to have a problem with it. As you said earlier, it's usually, you know, carpal tunnel syndrome and some of these other problems that involve inflammation of joints or fingers caused by long-term repetitive actions are most common in trades in which a handheld tool is used for long periods of time. I don't consider the standard computer keyboard to be a really stressful thing to use, but if somebody's already got a problem such as arthritis, it could very well be aggravated by prolonged use. But it really depends on how long people use a keyboard and how they use it. I know that some people press extremely hard on keyboard keys even though they take a relatively small amount to activate them, and that could aggravate the problem as well.
And those are the ones that probably learn to type on a manual typewriter, I can probably guess. 263-WXXI, our number. Let's go to the phones. Good afternoon, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. You're on the air. Let's see if we can hear that. Caller, can you hear us? Now, it looks like we may have some problems technically with getting that call up. Can you hear us now, caller?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Oh, yeah, I got to turn down my radio. I have an idea for the carpal tunnel syndrome, and I'll freely give it to whoever's listening.
Okay.
What if you put little accelerometers inside all the keys or in the interfaces of the keys? And what you could do then, theoretically, is alter your hand position and the amount of force that you would then thereby initiate with the with each of your fingers, and you could set up a little routine where the person would have a little bit of stress in one direction for 2 minutes, and then the computer would automatically change the accelerometers and do it the other way. Just that's a great human factors idea, and then nobody would get this terrible syndrome. How's that?
That's an interesting concept. I don't know how practical it would be on that scale. That's curious, David. What do you think of that?
Well, everything I say is curious, sir. So
that's interesting.
Are you saying that this would you would vary the amount of pressure required to activate the keys?
Well, imagine a three-dimensional system, sir, such that you would have, and there's probably human factors data available on this now. You know what the normal range of motion is on hands and arms and all that kind of stuff. What you do is you figure out what would be a normal type, non-negative type use of the hands. And then what you do is you let the computer simulate through random number generators or whatever degree of accelerometry required on all these different keys and possibly a wrist position. And you could either adjust the height and the angle of the keyboard and the accelerometry of each of the keys. And I think that could be a real easy program to do, and if you could store it in ROM, it would be perfect.
That's intriguing.
So anyway, that's my free gift to WXXI, and I give them full rights. So there, you don't have to do any more fundraising.
Well, I don't know about that.
Anyway, you guys are great. God bless you.
Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
263-WXXI. You never know what you're going to hear on the radio. You never know what you're going to get on sound bites. It's a rather intriguing idea. I don't know how immediately practicable it would be, but it's, I must admit it's kind of intriguing to hear about it. It raises something else, too. Has anybody thought about reformatting or changing the designs of keyboards or just rearranging some of the keys of functions or something like that to try to make things easier to use? And would it make any difference if they did?
As in move the position of different letters to different locations?
Well, I know. I guess that's been tried at various times, hasn't it? Without much success, right?
Right. I mean, I think the main point here is let's pick a standard and let's stick with it because people are trained on it and that's where they're going to stay. I think that if you try to change the position of keys, you would immediately exclude all this learning that people have had. And the important thing is that they learn it one way.
Of course, even aside from the normal typewriter keyboard, which computers basically inherited, there are an awful lot of other keys, function keys and numerical keys and that kind of thing. Have we put those where they really should be, and then also the track balls and the mice? I don't know if that's really the appropriate plural for the mouse that we use, but I'm wondering if we've done it right that way, too.
As in the F keys that you see along the top and on the side?
Right.
I think that they've adopted some standards. I am not aware that any testing has been done to see if they're in the optimum position. I think the important thing is that they're close to the rest of the keys, which they've definitely accomplished. And the how critical it is, I don't think it's not as much of an issue because these F keys, if you will, are not made to be pressed all the time. In other words, you're basically pressing the QWERTY keys, the A through Z and the 1 through 9, and the F keys are something you hit for a special function. So I think they've accomplished their goal of making them close to the rest of the keys. I think that it might be better to have them all in their own little group, as you see to the left, than along the top.
Now, this fellow suggested, I think, something else. He was talking about infinite variability of key pressure, I guess,
right,
is one thing. I don't know if that would be technically practical, but I wonder if you can find any way to adjust the pressure that you'd use on the keys and if it would be desirable or if it would help.
In other words, if the person could select the amount of pressure to activate it, I think that would be a desirable thing, but I think that through the testing that's been done, they've determined that your standard keyboards have the adequate amount of pressure. People do need feedback. They do need to press down on a key and get some tactile feedback, and that's a real important part of it. The amount of pressure, I believe, is more than acceptable, and I don't know how much that would enhance people's ability to work with keyboards, but it may be a nice feature, but you're talking about extra money there as well.
Probably large bucks, aren't we?
Could be.
And when we're talking about, in many cases, complete systems under $1,000, you can imagine what would cost to do with all this kind of thing. Probably several hundred dollars, I would think.
Right. I'd be curious to find out if IBM or some other computer company has looked into that.
Probably everybody's tried it at one time or another, but I guess the fact that it's not there out on the market may tell you about the cost or the benefit.
Is it something people are willing to pay for? Do they need it?
Be an interesting question to put to our audience at 263-WXXI, where we're going to take another call right now on Sound Bites. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm the same guy again. I'll tell you who or how to go about doing it technically to do it cheaply. Little accelerometers, you can get the information from NASA. There's some public domain information through the National Technical Information Service in Virginia, and little accelerometers are very inexpensive. I've used them as in a lab work deal at Xerox back in the good old days, and I'm telling you, it'd be really inexpensive, And it's just a thought. And if you make it so the operator does not have to change it, but it would go through a regular pattern that would be selectable by ROM, I would think that somebody like Intel could make that for nothing. And there's got to be a tremendous market in avoiding carpal tunnel syndrome. It's got to be.
Okay. What I'm envisioning is bringing people in, having this accelerometer attached, bringing people in, like 30 different people, and having them try it out. And
minimum 33, sir, for any kind of confidence.
Okay. And find out what, you know, what their preference is, and so thereby establish a norm as well as a range. But what you're talking about is actually having this in the product. It would be a rather inexpensive addition to the product.
Yeah, or one you could sell is avoid carpal tunnel syndrome. Of course, you sign a disclaimer that limits us from complete liability in case it doesn't work. But anyway, and all you do is you make 100 different variabilities, and it randomly selects the amount of tension on the keys. The keys would remain in the same position. I heard your other previous statement. And therefore, you know, maybe we could help people out a lot.
I think we could, and I think that one thing, my opinion right now, and from what I've read, is that things like carpal tunnel syndrome are very rare occurrences with computer keyboards. But if they do turn out through research and people's complaints to be a bigger issue than I think they are at this time, then I think this would be a very worthwhile undertaking.
Well, it's got to be very, very hard and terrible to have that feeling. Imagine those terrible nervous, anyway, enough of that madness. On to another topic. I'll leave you guys alone. Have fun.
Well, thank you very much for calling. 263-WXXI is our number. Soundbites of the program, and we're delighted to hear from you. Talking about ergonomics and computers, this segment of the program with David Metropolis Rundus, who is a human factors engineer, part of whose duty is to do precisely that, to work out the best relationship between you and your machine. I want to talk, while we're on the subject of keyboards, which is where our hands meet the machine, so to speak. One of the big problems, I'm told, is our relationship physically to the keyboard, and I'm wondering what the ideal relationship ought to be.
The ideal, there are some established or ideal heights, and sometimes those are violated, especially in the cases where you have your keyboard on the table in which your computer is, because most standard tabletops are 31 inches, but the recommended height for a keyboard, and that's if you take a tape measure and you're in your office measuring from the floor to the home row on your keyboard, should be within the 28 to 31 inch range.
We should define home row as to what that is for those who've never taken touch typing too.
I believe that's the third row or the middle row of your keyboard.
And so that should be that stated height then.
28 to 31 inches,
depending, I guess, on how big you are?
The 28 to 31 inch range covers most people.
And there's also an ideal height, isn't there, for a monitor, too?
Right. And if you also take your tape measure in your office, you should measure from the floor to the middle of your monitor screen, the middle of what you're looking at. And the middle there from the floor should be in the range of 37 to 43 inches.
Again, depending on your height and the height of the trunk of your body, right?
Yes.
263-WXXI, our number. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Two quick points. One is I didn't hear him mention amber color for monochrome monitors. And the other is I'm with you on having the function keys off to the in a group by themselves off to the left somewhere. Mostly because that's what I've gotten used to. On intensity, I may be a bit of a maverick. At least other people have disagreed with me. I personally keep the intensity low, partly to reduce phosphor burnout. And I don't find it any harder in my eyes, although other people don't seem to agree.
Well, what is your office viewing situation? Are you in a well-lit office or a dimly lit office?
Well, I'm retired now, but I used to be in a fairly well-lit office, although it was set up for a computer, so it was not too terribly bright, and I did not have glare. I know I have to turn it up if the sun is shining in or something like that.
Okay.
Mostly I'm working at home, and the light is on a table alongside the computer, so it doesn't shine on the screen.
Uh-huh. Well, once again, you know, the intensity is something, and the phosphor burn is definitely an issue, but in terms of the intensity issue, if you're in a room that has a lot of glare, then it could help, but, I mean, it depends on the individual, and I think that most people would agree with yourself that to keep the intensity down as much as possible is best for the computer screen, as long as you can do your work most efficiently.
And I think...
But most non-technical people don't think of that. I've seen too many oscilloscopes burned out.
Of course, I got to be honest about one thing. This is my own personal prejudice. I'd like you both to react to it. I'd kind of rather like to see a CRT tube burn out than have my eyes burn out. If faced with the choice between the two, I can replace a CRT on a monitor. I can't replace my eyes.
Well, I don't seem to feel any eye strain from it.
Well, good.
Then is he okay?
I guess so.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling. Let's take another call right now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I had a question earlier. You mentioned that a monitor should be opposite from a printed page. In other words, it should be a black background with light letters.
Yes.
I just wanted to make sure I had that clear because I've had a Macintosh for years, and, of course, that's a white background, black letters, and now I'm using a VGA monitor, and I've been running around setting all my software to run white on or black on white.
Yeah. From the human factors research that has been done has determined that people can read faster and work faster with less fatigue if, in fact, you do have light letters. And once again, it does come down to personal preference to a certain degree.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, and thank you very much for calling. So, that seems to imply that maybe the Mac world isn't necessarily the most ergonomically correct. I don't know. We may get some calls on that one, too. And hello, you're on the air.
Hello. Back on the keyboard design thing and relating it to carpal tunnel syndrome, yeah, I think the carpal tunnel tends to come from physical strain, a long period of time doing hard work of some kind or another, repetitive stuff that damages the nerve. But it's hand position that aggravates it for people. And I did see, I think it was on XXI, Channel 21 television, somebody or other was working on redesigning keyboard shape and configuration, going along with when you raise your hands in a natural position, they tend to be palms facing each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the keyboard they were working on was designed in two separate halves. It had been split in half, and they were in spherical, like sections of spheres with the keys set up that way.
So on the left and right side, they started raising up more? Or...
No, the keyboard was actually divided in two. There were two separate keyboards,
okay.
And each hand went into a semicircular kind of position with palms facing each other to hit the keys that way. And struck me that it seemed like a real logical solution to things.
It sounds very logical. I'm not familiar with this, but do you know, did they do any experimentation to see how it compared to the regular keyboard? And once again, before you answer, I just have to add that there's a learning effect. I mean, you might not be able to find out if people perform better with this new design than with the traditional design just because they've been working with the traditional design keyboard all their lives.
Yeah, retraining's always a problem with anything, I guess, but typing's not all that hard, you know,
right?
To learn or redo. But I don't remember from the television show how far things had gotten with research on it.
Interesting question. I wish we had more time to discuss it, but I do thank you very much for calling. This is one of those topics that obviously we have not by any means exhausted at this point. I wish we had more time, in fact, to do it, but unfortunately our time for this segment is just about up. I have time only to say thank you to David Metropoulos Rundis for being with us and letting us in on the world of human factor engineering and making our layout for our computer work a little bit more comfortable than it otherwise might be. David, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And coming up in the next segment, just a minute or so from now, we will be looking at the world of email. It'll be brought to you by the letter E, so to speak. Electronic mail is going to be the focus of our discussion in part two of today's Sound Bites. You're listening to Sound Bites on WXXI 1370. I'm Bob Smith. And in this portion of the program, where we invite your calls, incidentally, at 263-WXXI, 263-9994, we're going to be talking about email, electronic mail. Now, you probably think that you know what electronic mail is, but your image of it, as mine is, and how PC users can apply the technology, may just be a little bit too limited to fit the reality. We're going to find out what it all entails right now and how you can use it and get involved in transmitting anything from voice information to video to what have you by electronic mail Right now we have with us Ted Mead of PC Cubed, the Picture City Personal Computer Programming Club. Ted, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks. Nice to be here.
Let's define what electronic mail is, first of all.
Well, electronic mail, initially the way electronic mail started, and it's actually been around for many, many years, it was the ability for an individual user to create a memo or a letter and be able to send that memo or letter to another person or to several people who were also sharing the computer system. And some people feel that it's just been the advent of personal computers that have brought in email, but in fact, if there are many of our listeners from Kodak, they're very frequently using a product called Profs, which is an IBM product that has been around for many, many years, which is fundamentally an electronic mail system.
That was mainframes talking to mainframes and minis to minis and minis to mainframes and the whole bit?
Mostly Profs is mostly a mainframe product, and IBM is known for its host systems. It's the great big computer systems and just terminals, what we call dumb terminals, sitting out there at the user's desk, and all of the, there really isn't any mail going on because it's just shifting it around within the same one computer. But now with the advent of personal computers initially were not connected to anything. So the options for electronic mail were zero. If you weren't connected to anything, you weren't going to be able to send anything back and forth. In the last few years, local area networks, sometimes called LANs, L-A-Ns, have now joined a lot of personal computers up, and now we're seeing a new resurgence of electronic mail through these local area networks and the PCs.
Now, I can envision, first of all, one limited use, which would be sending messages from one workstation to another or from one computer to another within a business complex, let's say within Kodak or within Xerox or within any small area network up and down from the top floor to the bottom floor or something like that. I can see that as one thing. That's not all, is it?
No, it's not all. There's another area that electronic mail has become popular, has been with third-party services like MCI Mail, AT&T Mail, a few other companies that provide actually worldwide networks, and where you can, with a personal computer, even with just a dumb terminal and a modem is a device that lets you send computer information on phone lines, you can dial into one of these networks and you can send messages to any other user of the same service. And we're going to start seeing now an increase, though, of the corporate electronic mail, as you were talking about, from floor to floor, and this public service electronic mail, we're going to start seeing them marry soon. And you're going to see, you're going to be able to sit there at your corporate workstation and say, gee, I'm going to set a memo up, and here's the 10 people I want to send it to. Five of them may be a floor above you. Five of them may be accessed through this third-party service. You won't know about it. Being a user, you won't see. You'll just say, send this one to John, and this one to Joe, and this one to Tim. And it will go all over the world.
And my computer will be smart enough to be able to send it to the right destination, or at least to link up with somebody or something who knows how to send it to the right destination?
Someone or something that knows, yeah. The computers themselves obviously have no intelligence. It's only what we program them to do. But you will have, they use words like post office and mailboxes in electronic mail. And there's a lot of similarity to...
Yes.
To that analogy, in that there will be a postmaster of a post office that will keep the mailing addresses and the zip codes, if we can extend that analogy, so that while your own individual computer may not know where John, Tim, and Joe reside, that the central hub through which you're going would know, and that would be able to distribute it.
It won't necessarily get lost in a bag that gets thrown on a floor someplace at a post office either, you hope.
That's the interesting part about electronic mail. In fact, some people were saying that they should randomize electronic mail, so every once in a while, things would intentionally be lost, just so you'd have the excuse of, oh, gee, it must have got lost in the mail.
Now, wait a minute. We don't want to do something like that. Nah. We don't want to do that. Just just to repeat the post office experience. And they won't do. Will they do it for 25 cents a pop, too, or maybe even cheaper than that, actually, on a local call, wouldn't it?
Well, it would be a local call. The various services do have different costs to them, depending on how much information you're sending and how far you're sending it and so on.
And come to think of it, if you're curious about it, your chance to access some information on the subject is absolutely free by picking up 263-WXXI. That is 263-9994. Dial in on this segment of Sound Bites, where we are talking about electronic mail and how you can use that particular type of service through your computer to communicate more quickly and effectively. Ted Mead of PC Cubed is with us. 263-WXXI is the number to find out how all of this applies to you, how you can make use of it to communicate more effectively and more interestingly. I'm wondering who all is likely to use it. We've talked so far about communications within business, but a personal computer user at home has got to have a lot of potential applications for this kind of thing, right?
Absolutely. Where this comes in is with the electronic bulletin boards. And these are dial-in types of services. Some of them are operated just by individuals that are operating because they're interested and because it's free. And there's a certain amount of what we call messaging there. And messaging is what we call a chat mode. So that if somebody else is hooked up at the same time, you can converse through your keyboards to this other individual. If you're as poor a typist as I am, it's a lot quicker to pick up the phone to talk to them. But for the good typist, that works quite well. But there are then these services I mentioned before, like MCI Mail, where an individual and any person, it doesn't have to be part of a corporation. For I think the sign-up fees are $10-$20. It's not an expensive service. Can get a mailbox on MCI Mail, and they can start sending electronic messages to any other user. And there are literally millions of users that are on MCI Mail. And all you need for that is the PC, a modem, and a phone line.
And of course, they have similar services too. I know 3M was running EasyLink, which is I don't think even required a PC. You could buy one of their terminals, or you could rent one of their terminals. Although it could use through a PC if you wanted it, and there are all kinds of others kicking around out there, aren't there?
That very, very right, yes. The one that I've mentioned a couple times, MCI Mail, is probably the most used for that. A couple of other services, one called CompuServe and another called The Source, are more frequently used because they are database services. In other words, that you can go on to The Source and find out airline schedules if you want, or similar types of information, right. But they also have an electronic mail portion to them.
I've tried a couple of those services, although I haven't signed up for any of them yet. I've tried CompuServe, and I've also tried Prodigy, that new one that IBM and Sears is marketing so aggressively
yes.
out there right
Aren't
now.
They? Yes.
They sure are. And I'm wondering what you think of those as opposed to the more traditional, non-commercial or only semi-quasi-commercial billboards that are out there.
They're extremely different. That what Prodigy is trying to market, or their edge as they perceive it to be, is the accessibility of information, airline schedules as being one, but also my understanding, although I haven't used their service, is that you can actually purchase items through this electronic bulletin board.
It's a giant Sears catalog. It's not your typical bulletin board. It's a Sears catalog.
Exactly.
Plus.
Yes. It's an electronic Sears catalog is exactly what it is. But on top of that, they do also supply you information. As opposed to the typical bulletin board, tends to be more for hobbyists to exchange ideas and to exchange programs. And sometimes exchange viruses. That's another problem that one can get onto.
Right. They do swap software, shareware back and forth that way, as we talked about before, and it's not always secure.
That's very, very, very true. It is not always. And one has to tread carefully when one gets the information from a bulletin board. The PC Cubed, not to put a plug in, but the PC Cubed bulletin board, the operators of that are extremely careful and thoroughly test software to make sure that there are no hidden problems in it of any kind.
One thing I'm curious about, most of these non-commercial bulletin boards tend to be a lot more regional in scope. There aren't too many national 800-type services or anything like that, are there?
No, that's sort of the fun of it. It's you can imagine it's the outgrowth of the ham radio operator. It's a similar mentality that, people, these are typically individuals that have set up a computer in their house and just enjoy having people come in and share information with them, they're not going to spend the money to have an 800 number or a Watts line. They do exchange other phone numbers of other bulletin boards, and sometimes it's fun. People do long distance on their own nickel, go out and go long distance to access other bulletin boards.
As far as the cost is concerned, it's about the same as any long distance or local call, right?
Exactly the same. The phone company does not know what you're using that phone line for. So it is merely you are using that phone line. It happens to be a modem, and I think of a modem as singing down the phone line. If you've ever heard of a modem, it makes these weird electronic noises. And but that versus voice going down at the phone company doesn't make any difference, and there's no charge difference for that.
They could care less if it's modem chirps or if it's voice or whatever.
The one little thing to note is that if you have some of these additional services from your local phone company, such as the call waiting feature, where I don't know that you have that on your own personal phone, but what this is that you'll be talking on the phone, and if another person calls your number, you get a little tone that says, gee, there's another person trying to get through, and you can kind of swap between them. You want to be able to have an additional service, which costs you additional money, of course, that lets you occasionally turn...